This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome, everybody, to the second day of this Genzoe session. We're looking at Dogen's essay called Makahanya Haramitsu, which is Japanese for Maha Prajna Paramita. And so the topic of this essay is the Prajna Paramita teachings of the Heart Sutra that we chanted this morning, Dogen's kind of commentary or reworking of the Heart Sutra on the topic of prajna. And does everybody have a copy of the essay, which you can keep and write on and take home as you wish? And we'll review some of what we talked about the past days. But since this is the topic of prajna, there was this sign that used to hang in the dining room, and I found it the other day in the shop, and I thought it was relevant to this session. It says, pure practice depend on prajna. Let true dharma shine throughout Jikoji. You know the story on this?
No idea.
Really?
No.
Jerome? Somehow, I always used to appreciate it in the sitting there in the dining room. It's kind of strange. When I saw it, I projected the idea that this was a saying of Koban, founder Koban Roshi. Just because it sounds like, it's not quite even a sentence. But somebody did a nice job of carving it. And how appropriate for this session. In fact, today's section is on depending, relying on, taking refuge in prajna. This is pure practice. And in this way, we all let true dharma shine throughout Jikoji. This is our zazen instruction for the rest of the session. I'll leave it as a reminder. So you might be wondering, what is Maha Prajna Paramita? Maha means, in its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, is utterly beyond location. Maha Prajna. We looked at the etymology of this term, Sanskrit term, prajna. Pra is related to the English terms supreme and premium. Pra, like the highest grade. And nya is related to the English knowing, gnosis, knowledge. So we could literally translate prajna. Premium knowing, supreme knowing. And regular knowing gets us around in the world pretty well. We can find the Zendo door and the bathroom door and so on with with regular knowing, but this premium, high octane knowing keeps everything running really smoothly. It keeps things from getting too rough. Everything is humming along, premium knowing, supreme knowing. And we might hear this and think, well, this supreme knowing, we just have the regular knowing. How do we get the supreme, premium knowing? It must be very expensive compared to the regular knowing. But actually, Hakurin Zenji, in his commentary on the Heart Sutra, says regarding this supreme knowing, prajna, he says all people have it with no exceptions, and it's flawlessly perfect in each one of us. And yet, we never fully know it until our fingers let go from the edge of the cliff. Hakurin says, we're fully endowed with it as our birthright. It's presently functioning right now without any flaws or hindrances or obstructions. And yet, to fully appreciate it, to fully know this knowing, we're kind of like hanging on the cliff edge and have to let go with our fingers and drop. This present knowing knows everything in a kind of regular way, like this is a piece of paper. I know it and you know it. That's kind of regular knowing of things that seem like they're outside of knowing. And then the supreme knowing only knows knowing. So you could say when supreme knowing looks at the piece of paper, and it can know it as a piece of paper, but it also knows that the piece of paper is not anything other than the knowing of it. There's no piece of paper in addition to knowing. That's supreme, premium knowing. And that's happening all the time, actually. It's naturally this knowing knows only itself. This knowing only knows itself, taking the form of pieces of paper and people and the sound of fire and birds and then mist. It only knows itself, but itself is manifesting as the sound of birds in the mist and fire and the sensations of the body and thoughts. Those so-called experiences are, if we look very carefully, we see that they're nothing other than the experiencing of them. There aren't any experiences in addition to all-encompassing maha experiencing. Oh yeah, so that's maha and prajna, and then paramita. Uchiyama Roshi's commentary on this Dogen essay, he says the meaning of prajna para, or the meaning of paramita is the true self manifests the true self and completely lives out that self. That's the meaning of paramita. The true self is another name, I would say, for this supreme, premium knowing, all-inclusive, maha, all-inclusive, boundless, dimensionless, supreme knowing, and paramita that is often translated as perfection or transcendent. Here is the true self manifests the true self and completely lives out that self. And all of us are nothing other than supreme knowing, and yet we're manifesting as these unique bodies and minds that are really nothing other than the true self. And then when we're really with that, then we're completely living out the self in harmony with itself. So knowing, supreme knowing, knows only knowing. That's already happening. That's just like reality as it is. But then we as practitioners can come to know that knowing knows only knowing. Knowing knows only knowing, but we don't necessarily believe it or understand it or verify it personally. That would be knowing, but knowing knows only knowing. So that's just the kind of background up to today. This essay of Dogen, written in 1233, was, apart from a few practice instructions, like his universal instructions for Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi, and the wholehearted practice of the way, Bendo-wa, which were originally not included in Dogen's Shobo Genzo collection. The first essay that Dogen wrote, maybe with the Shobo Genzo in mind, that he would write maybe 100 essays, and eventually he did make it to 95 before he died. This was maybe the first essay consciously included by Dogen in the Shobo Genzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And a couple months after he wrote this, Dogen wrote the Genjo Koan, which then later he thought we should put that first in the Shobo Genzo in some versions. So this is very early Dogen. And later Dogen essays, he takes up all these Chinese Zen stories, koan stories, and comments on them. That's kind of became his kind of standard style. But this Makahanya Haramitsu, Manifestation of Great Prajna, doesn't have any Zen koans in it. He hadn't developed that style. He does. The one Zen thing that he quotes is his teacher's poem about the wind bell, which isn't really considered like a Zen koan, but actually, we'll pick this up maybe tomorrow and we'll talk about that. Dogen collected a bunch of koans in his extensive record, and he included this wind bell poem of his teacher as a kind of koan. So I guess we could say that That's the koan, the Zen story here. But since this doesn't include a lot of Zen stories, I kind of miss that. I kind of miss the Zen stories in this writing of Dogen. So I'll just tell one before we go into this essay. I just looking around for classic Chinese Zen stories on Mahaprajna. I found one this morning. It's from the Zen ancestor Changsha. A little bit obscure ancestor, but actually one of my favorites. His unique take on things. Even though his lineage died out sometime after he lived. Changsha said, kind of famously, maybe the most well-known thing that he said. Actually, maybe there's a few well-known things, like when you get to the top of the 100-foot pole, you should take a step forward. That's Changsha, classic saying. But here, Changsha says, the whole universe is within the radiant light of the self. Some of you might have heard that phrase. The whole universe in 10 directions is within the radiant light of the self, the true self. Which Yamaroshi says, Paramita is the true self, manifesting the true self and completely living out that self. In the old days, Changsha said, the whole universe is within the radiant light of the self. In the whole universe, there is nobody who is not myself or is not his true self. This is like a great Zen statement of non-separation. He's not even saying everyone's connected with me or related to me. He's saying more radically, everybody is me. There's nobody in the universe who's not myself. Here we're talking about big self, all-inclusive self. Prajna Paramita. So those lines are somewhat known in the Zen world. A teaching of Changsha. Dogen comments on them elsewhere. But that Dharma talk of Changsha went on from there. The whole universe is within the radiant light of the self. In the whole universe, there's nobody who's not the self. I always tell you that the Buddhas throughout all time, along with all sentient beings, are all the light of Mahaprajna. So this sounds to me like he's saying that the radiant light of the true self is also called Mahaprajna. And all Buddhas and all sentient beings are the light or the radiance of Mahaprajna, all-inclusive, premium knowing. Before the light radiates, how can sentient beings know anything? The light of knowing. Before this light radiates, how can we know anything? Before the light radiates, there aren't any Buddhas or sentient beings. Where else do mountains, rivers, and the earth come from? Where else do the mountains, rivers, the earth the sound of the fire, the bird calls in the mist, the zendo, the kitchen, and the toilet. Where else do they come from? Before the light radiates. Before the light radiates, there aren't any Buddhas or Satchitanas. The light of Mahapragna. Everyone has it, whether we like it or not. And if we might be wondering if this is true, if there is this knowing for each of us, we can ask ourselves right now, is there knowing? Am I knowing? I might not know the meaning of Sanskrit terms. That's kind of regular knowing. But the supreme knowing is just knowing that's always present. And we can ask, is there knowing here? And we can answer, yes, of course there is. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any hearing of that question. And we can all affirm easily and effortlessly that there is knowing, basic knowing is present. And when we say, yes, of course it is, then what is it that knows this so confidently, knows that knowing is present? What is it that knows that knowing is present right now? We might say, I do. Well, who's that? Isn't it really that knowing knows that knowing is present? There's nobody else in addition to the knowing that knows that knowing is present. That's how we can know that knowing is present. And then furthermore, that's not so hard, I think, to know that knowing is present. And if we're wondering who knows that, it's just the same knowing that is known, knows this knowing. There's nobody in addition needed to know that knowing is, that this is knowing. But or what's maybe more difficult is to know that knowing knows only knowing. Because we might think that knowing can also know pieces of paper and the fire sound. But to come to know that the piece of paper and the fire sound are themselves just knowing. They're just manifestations of knowing. They're expressions of knowing. They're the display of knowing. That's might take more investigation. As Changsha says, I always tell you that the Buddhas in the three times, along with all sentient beings, are all just the light or the radiance of Mahapragna. Before this light radiates, how can sentient beings know anything? Before the light radiates, there aren't any Buddhas or sentient beings. Where else do mountains, rivers, and the earth come from other than the light of our true self? The mountains, the deer, are just the light of true self. where the deer stroll through the grasses and nibble them at their will is nothing but maha prajna. And if they know that, then it's maha prajna paramita. So we're in this essay of Dogen, we're down in the middle of the first page. In the assembly of Shakyamuni Buddha, this is a quote. So paragraph, this paragraph and the Buddha's response, the next two, these two paragraphs are all a quote from the Maha Prajna Paramita Sutra in 100,000 lines, the large premium knowing gone beyond scripture. And the sutra says this: in the assembly of Shakyamuni Buddha, there was a monk who said to himself, I will take refuge in this very profound manifestation of prajna. For those who weren't here yesterday, this translation is using manifestation as a translation of paramita, interestingly. And this may be because the theme of the essay is that the eyes, nose, tongue, body, mind, deer, fires, birds, floors, ceilings, walls, tiles, and pebbles are all prajna. That's kind of Dogen's teaching. They are this premium knowing. Everything is. That's what, if you want to catch up later, the first half of the page is basically going through all these lists of things, of experiences, and saying they're all prajna. Unlike the Heart Sutra, it says, there is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. Dogen says, the eye is prajna, the ear is prajna, the nose is knowing, the tongue is knowing. So he puts a positive twist on emptiness. This knowing, this present knowing that we're all sharing, space-like knowing, is like space in the sense that you can't get a hold of it and it has no location. That's what we mean by empty knowing in this case. It's emptiness, but for Dogen in this essay, this emptiness is a knowing emptiness. It's a vibrant, radiant, bright emptiness that knows itself as the myriad grasses. So that's when we hear manifestation of prajna. It's prajna paramita is what's being translated. And where it says, I will take refuge in, that's kind of nice, I think, the meaning there. And but literally, the Chinese says, I respectfully venerate, or I honor and prostrate to prajna paramita, more literally. It has that word rai, you say rai hai, it's like prostration, which means like to venerate. But maybe Kaz and Ed, who translated this essay, maybe they felt like venerate sounds like putting something outside us, that we're like, I put the Prajnaparamita Sutra on the altar and then bow to it. Maybe it has that feeling. So maybe they thought if we say take refuge in it, it makes it more intimate, makes it more non-dual, maybe that's why they chose refuge. But it's a different Chinese term than the usual term for refuge. But in the assembly of Shakyamuni Buddha, in that sangha, there was a monk who said to himself, thought to himself, I take refuge in the profound Prajnaparamita, or I respectfully venerate Prajnaparamita because it's awesome. And then the monk goes on to think, although nothing arises or ceases in the midst of this Prajnaparamita, the precept skanda, the samadhi skanda, the wisdom skanda, the emancipation skanda, and the emancipation of views skanda are established. So he's now going to go on for this rest of this paragraph to talk about all these types of realizations really within Buddha's teaching. Buddha taught all these different types of realization, and it's kind of like he goes through all of them. So maybe we can unpack them a little. But remembering the point here is not so much this detailed list, but just that, that I think the point is that within Prajnaparamita, this spacious knowing that allows everything to appear, nothing that appears within this space truly arises or ceases. Things appear to arise and cease, but actually what they really are, all these things arising and ceasing in this space, are really nothing other than the space itself. Or the sound of the fire and the sight of the deer are nothing other than knowing. Are nothing other than Prajnaparamita. And Prajnaparamita is like space. It doesn't arise or cease. So that you could say the actual nature of the fire sound, the actual nature of the deer vision, that in their true nature, they don't arise and cease. They appear to be objects arising and ceasing. But what is really happening here is just one space appearing as arising and ceasing. This is called very profound, as this monk said, right? Which means that it's not easy to grok or verify. It goes so against our intuitive sense that like this cup did arise at some point. Somebody made it and that it even arises in our mind when we experience it, and it will cease when it breaks apart and when we stop experiencing it. That's our usual way of experiencing things, imagining that things really do arise and cease. They're impermanent. That's what arising and ceasing means, but they really are these impermanent arising and ceasing things. But within this Prajnaparamita, no things actually arise and cease, even though they appear to. In other words, they're just the unchanging space of Prajnaparamita that appears to, or appears as the 10,000 things arising and ceasing. And I think this is this point about no arising and ceasing, which the Heart Sutra actually says too. Right? And I think near the end of the essay, Dogen brings up the section of the Heart Sutra where it says, all things, all dharmas, all things, all phenomena, all experiences are marked by emptiness. They have the mark, the stamp, the seal of emptiness. They neither arise nor cease. They're not tainted nor pure. They neither increase nor decrease. So that's one of my favorite lines of the Heart Sutra, and I think it's an underrated line. We love, of course, that form itself is emptiness. That's maybe the real punchline of the sutra. But a less celebrated line is, all things that are marked by emptiness don't arise and cease. And one reason I think that it's a nice one to remember is because many times people equate emptiness with merely the teaching of impermanence. You say, well, everything only lasts for a moment, therefore it's empty. We think because everything arises and ceases, because it's impermanent, that's the meaning of emptiness. So, and it's true that everything is impermanent, arising, ceases. That's the Buddha's teaching of impermanence, which is a profound teaching, that everything is radically impermanent. But this Prajnaparamita teaching of emptiness is very profound, according to this monk. I think it's more profound, meaning it's harder to accept than impermanence. Is a little more obvious, maybe. And the difference is being pointed out in this section of the Heart Sutra, where in emptiness, the things that are empty do not arise and cease. That's how, in impermanence, the things that are marked by impermanence, they arise and cease. That's what impermanence means. But in emptiness, things don't arise and cease. See how that's now the teaching of emptiness now different, almost sounds opposite from impermanence, right? Impermanence, things arise and cease. In emptiness, all these things do not arise and cease. That's like strange, isn't it? And it's not so much that the things are permanent, that they don't arise and cease because, like, the cup doesn't arise and cease because it's a permanent cup. It's not, that would be like sort of where we might think of the opposite of arising and ceasing impermanence. It's more that, the cup doesn't really arise in the first place and doesn't really cease in the first place. It appears to. It functions as if it does, which is very nice because then we can drink tea out of it. But the tea actually didn't actually really arise either. This is like very profound. But maybe we can open to it in various ways. And maybe this weekend's way of opening to it is this, looking at emptiness as like the space, the boundless, dimensionless space of knowing. This space is totally empty of any graspable characteristics. It's empty of any size and shape, and it's empty of coming and going, in other words, the space doesn't arise and cease. I think even when we're talking about physical space of the universe, it's one of the few things that doesn't arise and cease. Everything that's arising and ceasing is arising and ceasing in space. So the space of knowing is like that too. It's the space of knowing is always the same knowing. Which is why the more we open to this, the more we can maybe even feel more comfortable with the idea of our own impending death. Because there's, in this teaching, there is a reality that doesn't die. And that reality that doesn't die is also the reality that wasn't born. So it's not like this body and mind, but it's like, it's a reality that doesn't arise and cease, but that allows the appearance of all arising and ceasing. And that is said to be our true self, our true nature. So as a person, we will die. Even our individual consciousness, with its individual, perceptions and thoughts and memories, all that dies. But our true nature, our empty, radiance of Prajnaparamita, doesn't arise and cease. And then these things, these dharmas that are marked by emptiness, like this cup, the Heart Sutra is saying, also that doesn't arise and cease, because in its nature, it is nothing but the space itself. And in this case, we're saying it's nothing other than the knowing of it. And the knowing of the cup doesn't arise and cease. And is the cup something other than this knowing? We think that it is, usually. But this is the profound teaching, is that there's no cup in addition to the knowing of the cup. And the knowing of the cup that we call cup, that knowing is this knowing that doesn't arise and cease. This is hard to talk about, and it's hard to listen to. That's why this monk said to himself.
He kept it quiet.
Oh yeah, he didn't say it. It was too much to say out loud. The whole assembly would have been disturbed. He said it out loud. So he said to himself, quietly, I take refuge in this very profound Prajnaparamita. I respectfully venerate this Prajnaparamita. We can start to feel that way about Prajnaparamita. And then, you know, we can, the tradition, because we relate to, we usually relate to externally appearing things and people. Sometime after the Buddha lived, they started making images of the Buddha to bow to. The Buddha actually just is Prajnaparamita, right? But we, like, if we want to bow, we wouldn't know which direction to bow to Prajnaparamita. So we have to bow in all directions simultaneously, and that would be too hard. So then we put a Buddha on the altar and we bow to the Buddha, but we remember that what we're bowing to is unlocated, boundless Prajnaparamita. And then after they came up with the Buddha image, they thought, well, we don't need to limit it to Shakyamuni Buddha. So there's all of these bodhisattvas and names of Buddha, right, that we chant sometimes. And one of them is Prajnaparamita, the goddess Prajnaparamita. She is the mother of all Buddhas, our tradition says. Prajnaparamita, she's sometimes depicted, I think usually with four arms, but there's different versions. Prajnaparamita can manifest a human-like form, and generally a female form, because she gives birth to all Buddhas and all sentient beings and all deer and the sound of fire and the floor and the ceiling. She gives birth to all of them. She's the mother of all. It became this tradition of calling Prajnaparamita the mother. Like a Tibetan tradition, this whole corpus of Prajnaparamita sutras, they call like the mother collection, something like that. homage the Prajnaparamita, the lovely, the holy, the perfection of wisdom. Prajnaparamita gives light, unstained. The entire world cannot stain her. She herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowing of the own being of all things, the self nature of all things, and she doesn't stray away from it, the true self nature of all things. The Prajnaparamita of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of Dharma. She sets in motion the wheel of Dharma. Some of us thought it was Shakyamuni Buddha, but behind his back was Prajnaparamita. So the monk quietly thought, I take refuge. Oh, that I just recited is called the hymn to Prajnaparamita. We chant it sometimes as a way to venerate Prajnaparamita. And that's what this monk said. I respectfully venerate this very profound Prajnaparamita, although nothing arises or ceases in the midst of Prajnaparamita. All these realizations of Buddhas, all these amazing liberating understandings are established within Prajnaparamita. And this word established, couldn't quite, it's an unusual character to me, but I think one other translation is, designated. Carl Bielefeld translates it like that. I think that kind of fits more nicely because usually in the emptiness teachings, we want to be cautious about words like establishment. We don't want to establish things. So we could say, although nothing arises or ceases in the midst of Prajnaparamita, all these realizations that are about to be listed are designated as the stream enterer and the once returner and all these things. These are designations that can appear within this non-arising and ceasing Prajnaparamita. And they don't, so these, no thing it arises or ceases within this. So in other words, enlightenment or awakening is not something that arises within Prajnaparamita, strictly speaking. It's just the space of Prajnaparamita displaying itself as some experience of awakening. These are, you know, in a way you could say this list is kind of like experiences of awakening rather than the natural space of Prajnaparamita that is unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening, the single fold, supreme knowing that is actualized right now. Dogen says that earlier. That one is, we all share. And then there's these particular experiences within that this monk is saying, it's amazing that this stuff can arise within empty space. And his list is kind of nice. The first one is these five skandhas. So I think this is from the early Buddhist teachings. We usually think of the five aggregates or skandhas as this, you know, form, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness, as we talked about the other day. But those are, I think the Buddha called those are the impure skandhas, in the sense that like we grasp them and suffer by them. And then there's this set of five pure skandhas that are completely different. If we say the five impure skandhas are what we take to be, are what we imagine to be ourself, or we create the illusion of self out of these five impure skandhas, maybe we could say the five pure skandhas are what we create the true self out of, something like that. So these five are precepts, Shila, here it says the precept skandha. So Shila is like virtuous conduct. And they go, we could say from a Zen perspective, they're all simultaneous. In the southern school, there's no gradual approach. We could say there's five different aspects of reality or understanding. But I think originally they were taught, first we practice ethical conduct. First we try not to harm others, and we try to not cause a lot of trouble, because if we do, it's very hard to develop this like calm settling into samadhi. From a Zen perspective, we could say, from a non-dual perspective, we could say, first we realize that nobody is separate from us. We are all one prajna manifesting as these different beings. And therefore, it doesn't make any sense to harm others. As Changsha said, in the whole universe, there's not a single person who's not myself. And from that perspective, then no harm arises. That'd be kind of a Zen take on Shila, precepts or virtue. And then based on that, then there's Samadhi Skanda. Often we translate as concentration. I like to think of it these days as presence, the practice of presence. Usually we're like caught up thinking about our own past and future. And if we're really just settled into presence, that's like a unified mind. Samadhi really literally means like unified mind. And when we're not caught up in trying to get something for ourselves and harming others, then the mind settles into this unity, samadhi. And then based on that, wisdom or prajna is possible. We can open to the reality of this premium knowing when we're settled and present. And then based on, and so those three are commonly taught. Shila, samadhi, prajna are like the summary of Buddha's path. He taught over and over again. All practices are encompassed by shila, samadhi, and prajna. But then this list is five. Based on this practice, there's liberation, vimoksha. And I think that's a nice point that there's the practice of non-harm, the practice of presence, and the practice of opening to this supreme knowing, understanding. But then the point of all of this, we could say, is liberation, meaning freedom from discontent. And so it's nice that I think that this longer list that gets added in explicitly is when shila, samadhi, and prajna are cooking well, or that stew is all nicely mixed, then there is freedom, liberation, emancipation from discontent. Or in other words, when we're harming others, there's discontent for ourselves. When our mind is scattered and obsessed about the past and future, there's discontent for ourselves. when we're projecting duality, that everything is separate from us, that lack of wisdom is also discontent. So when those three become Shila, Samadhi, and Prajna, there is contentment, also called liberation from discontentment. And then, to top it off, as if that weren't good enough, then the fifth skanda, pure skanda, is I think I would translate it here as the literally the knowing and seeing of liberation. Not really the emancipation of views isn't usually how it's understood. It's more like seeing the seeing as view, which also gets translated as view. They didn't look at the Sanskrit probably. The character seeing is translation of drishti or view, but it's also a translation of darshana means seeing. So the Sanskrit term darshana jnana vimoksha literally means the jnana darshana vimoksha. I think that's what how jnana darshana vimoksha. So the knowing, the non-dual knowing and seeing of liberation. So there's the there's liberation. And maybe we would say one could be free from suffering and not notice that. As Dogen says, like, Buddhas do not necessarily notice that they're Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas. But in this case, like Shakyamuni Buddha actually knew that he was a Buddha because he said, now I have realized what had to be realized. It's done. Kind of like that. So that would be like the knowing and seeing of liberation. The jnana darshana vimoksha. The almost like the personal verification of freedom from suffering. I guess this fifth one. So I kind of like this five-part expansion of the more classical three-part Sila, Samadhi, Prajna. Sila, Samadhi, Prajna. And then let's remember that this is all about freedom from suffering. And that's how we're going to help free others from suffering, vimoksha. And then there, not only is there freedom, but there's like a verification, a knowing and seeing of this liberation. And why are they called skandhas? I mean, you could say the skandha means collection, kind of heap. And so, of course, there's a heap of precepts, a collection of precepts. There's a heap of different samadhis you could practice. There's a heap of different insights and wisdom. Is there a collection of liberations? Maybe, like, I'm stuck on this problem, I'm stuck on this problem, I'm stuck on this problem. Now I'm liberated from this. Maybe it's a huge collection, heap of liberations. And knowing and seeing liberation, it's hard to imagine a kind of collection, but maybe a knowing and seeing how of each individual liberation. So although nothing arises or ceases in the midst of prajnaparamita, still Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, Vimoksha, and Jnana, Darshana, Vimoksha are designated or established within this non-arising and ceasing empty space. Furthermore, the fruits of stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arhat are established. Another set of realizations in the Theravada tradition. Stream entry is the first direct non-conceptual verification of no separate self. We might say nothing in addition to knowing. And then once returner is now, it's like kind of like describing these realizations are kind of like in terms of how many more births there will be, which in modern times we may be even questioning this whole rebirth teaching of the Buddha, but we can really, it's kind of extra, we maybe feel we can throw that out, but I think interestingly in the early teachings, the stages of realization, the Buddha frames them in terms of like how many rebirths there will be. So it was kind of like a central issue, it looks like, to the Buddha, actually. And so the stream enter, the Buddha said, we still have a lot of habits remaining, even with this direct insight. But the really gross habits of extreme fixation on extreme separation, extreme greed and extreme hate, those are relieved with this insight. There's still attachment and aversion, the stream entry, but the extreme versions can no longer arise once this insight has been seen. It kind of makes sense. Yeah. So the Buddha said in these early sutras, seven more lifetimes maximum. Why did you say seven? Seems so random. But in other words, this process of out of control rebirth that's fueled by karma and klesha and all this. This is no longer, it's not going to go on forever, but it's still going to take a while, maybe.
Could it be like understood like propancha, just proliferation?
Keeps going.
Within a lifetime? No. We did it again. That could be.
Like a lifetime.
Lifetime.
It could be like that, but then probably then would be more than seven propanchas before the process is done. Maybe we could say 70 million propanchas.
Maybe seven is a minimum.
70 is a minimum. Oh, I had another thought. Wait, seven more thoughts. But yeah, we could see.
Like you do something seven times.
Yeah. So we could say like, extreme prapancha or extreme acting out of kleshas. Maybe it's something like that would be seven more times and then it decreases to once more and so on. Yeah. Also the Buddha said with this stream entry, this first direct vision, when the Dharma eye is opened in the early sutras, the Buddha used that term for stream entry is the opening of the Dharma eye. That may be where probably is what Dogen based the title Shobo Genzo, the true Dharma eye. This is old term of the Buddha for the first insight. And the Buddha also said seven more lifetimes, but also no more birth is possible in the so-called lower realms, like hell realms and hungry ghost realms, which we could see as extreme suffering, will no longer be possible. But normal suffering, average run-of-the-mill suffering, is still going to keep going. So you have to keep practicing. It's kind of the idea. And then what's the practice after stream entry is generally said to be? Then you're applying this insight to one's habits, particularly like greed and hate or grasping and aversion are arising. And then at the minute we're like I need to get that. And then we think, oh yeah, but there's no actual self here. This is just a conditioned habit. And so it doesn't really make sense. And then, so actually maybe I don't really need to get it after all. And like that process, hundreds of billions of times. When this grasping and aversion are like diminished more and more, the Buddha called this like the once returner, one more lifetime. And then when this grasping and aversion are basically eliminated, then it's a non-returner, not coming back after this lifetime. And then the arhat is in this, there's some more stuff to resolve, like subtler stuff, like pride and restlessness and all delusion. So this is a classic, you know, list of realizations. And also the pratik, so that's kind of that was the arhat's realization, stages of arhat realization. Then pratyeka Buddha's enlightenment is established. Pratyeka Buddhas are kind of like arhats, but they realize it on their own without teachers. That's the Buddha taught these solitary Buddhas. They don't study a lot of Dharma that's already been taught, and they don't receive teachings from teachers. They just like come to the insight on their own. That's the Pratyeka Buddhas. But then they also have a hard time conveying it to others because they're kind of non-relational types of beings. They like to just hang out in the forest alone. So they have this insight. They have this kind of awakening. But they're like, well, I never had any relationship to any teachers, so I don't know how to have any relationship with any students either. So I'll just hang out in the forest. Probably the Buddha's like rhinos, the Buddha said. And then unsurpassed complete perfect enlightenment is established or designated Buddha, Dharma. And so that would be like a Buddha's awakening. There's arhats, pratyeka Buddhas, and Buddhas. And Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha treasures are designated and established. The turning of the wondrous Dharma wheel and saving, awakening, sentient beings are established. It has that character for paramita. Crossing over sentient beings to the other shore. All these possibilities for liberation of self and others are designated and established. And the Buddha read the monk's mind, knew the monk's mind, and said to him, "Nyoze, Nyoze," which means thus. Thus it is. So it is. When we say, when the Buddha says, or Ananda says, thus have I heard at the beginning of sutras, it's nyoze, have I heard. And when the jewel mirror of samadhi says, the teaching of thusness is intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors, that's also nyoze, nyoze no ho. Is the Dharma of thusness. Or we could say, when the Dharma of that's right the Dharma of that's right is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. So it is. The very profound, deep Prajnaparamita is subtle and fathomless and measureless, the Buddha says. It's hard to fathom this kind of thing. the monk's understanding, Dogen now says, this monk's understanding was that taking refuge or respectfully venerating all things is respectfully venerating this prajna. Actually, it doesn't say prajna in the original text. It's more like a literal translation would be like, the monk's understanding was that respectfully venerating all things is respectfully venerating non-arising and ceasing. I think that would be maybe a more accurate way. Or is respectfully venerating all these attainments of realization that were just listed is respectfully venerating prajnaparamita. It doesn't arise and cease. These, I think we could say that these, all these realizations that were enumerated here are kind of like realizations that arise and cease. Like stream entry could say that kind of realization happens at a certain time and place. But in Zen, when we talk about the awakening, it doesn't happen at a certain time and place. The one that's always already present. So at the very moment of respectfully venerating or taking refuge, the prajna that establishes precept, samadhi, wisdom, and awakening sentient beings is actualized. And again, I would translate this more literally as the manifestation of prajna or the actualization of prajna. So here it's actually genjo, this term that Dogen likes, and we'll write a whole essay about a couple months later, genjo koan. Here it's hanya genjo, the actualization of prajna. So this manifestation or actualization of prajna is established, and shila, samadhi, and prajna save living beings or liberate living beings. That'd be another way to translate this sentence. Premium seeing is actualized, genjo, and virtue, presence, and knowing liberate living beings, or there is virtue, presence, and knowing, and the salvation of living beings. These are ways you could translate that. This is called, it actually doesn't say prajna, so this could refer to that whole sentence, I think. This is called mu. So usually emptiness is translated as ku. So, and ku is like, in Chinese, means like, literally it's the Chinese character for sky. That's how the Chinese chose to translate shunyata, which means like, void or absence or emptiness. Ku, and ku usually means sky, like empty sky, almost like space. That's the easy way that shunyata is translated. It's ku. But in this case, the character used is mu. So I wouldn't have said emptiness. I would say, this is called nothing. Mu literally means more like no or nothing. And it's very similar to emptiness, but it's a little different. Or not. This is called not. It just strikes me, I was wondering, why is Dogen bringing up this mu issue here? You know, he's been talking about emptiness, and it strikes me right now that maybe it's because he likes to play with words and kind of hidden meanings of things a lot, Dogen does. And the Heart Sutra, as you know, says, Therefore, given emptiness, there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound as well. And most of the sutra is this list of no, know this, know that, know that, know that. Though that character no, that word no is this character mu. So the Heart Sutra is like strewn with mu, right? It's like the most used Chinese character in the Heart Sutra, mu or wu in Chinese. And as we saw here, Dogen is rewriting the Heart Sutra. Instead of saying there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, he's saying it's a prajna eye, it's a prajna ear, it's a knowing noise, it's a knowing tongue, right? That's Dogen's thing here. So it could be that I could kind of see Dogen's mind going here, saying, because this is kind of his theme, right? So this whole taking refuge, venerating prajnaparamita and the manifestation of prajna here is called mu. And vice versa, that mu in the Heart Sutra is also called prajna. That's what Dogen does with it. He takes the mu from the Heart Sutra, the no from the Heart Sutra, and kind of transforms it into supreme knowing, into prajna in this essay. So the actualization, I think this is, this prajna is called mu, or this is called what he just said. This is called no, nothing. And, the actualization, the genjo of mu is designated. The manifestation of nothing is designated in this way. The actualization of nothing is designated as Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, and all this stuff. This is Prajna Paramita that is extremely subtle and fathomless. So, any questions?
So this designation is not manifestation.
No, yeah. Yeah, so this is hard in this translation. So designation here. So what Bielefeld translates as designation is this character. Does anyone have a pen? Linda, can I ask you about a Chinese character? Just because I'll just write it in big and show it to you. Maybe Jerome knows it too. How would you translate? Yeah. I think it's in a longer phrase too. But I think this is the pivotal character that we're looking at. That I think is being, here it would be what's being translated as established. And when I looked up this character, it said establish in the dictionary. To establish something, to kind of make something. But the intriguing part to me is that the left hand radical means word.
Yes.
Word, like speech, which makes me think that it's maybe something to do with designation. Because to designate is using words. So a great Buddhist scholar, Karl Bielefeld, translates this as designated. But that sounds very different from establish. Maybe not very different, but because we do establish things by designating them. Something like that? Planning? Planning. Oh, yeah, I think the dictionary also said planning or established. In a way, when you plan something, if you plan a building, you're kind of establishing the foundation of a building. And then designate would maybe be a different nuance of like, in the planning, you're also like, you're kind of designating it as a building, calling it a building. It's a little different feeling. Maybe.
Yeah, so the character itself has many, many meanings. And in the plan town, it's like
the context. Yeah, yeah, combine it. Yeah.
What's the sound?
Sure. In Chinese. So I didn't bring the whole compound with me. I can bring it tomorrow if I remember. It's just an example of how Chinese is a very dynamic language, right? Many nuances and meanings of each character and the context and the compounds make a difference. And this is Dogen's quoting from this old translation of the Prajnaparamita's large sutra, I think translated by Kumara Jiva, maybe. So it's translated from the Sanskrit. So it's, anyway, thanks for that. Yeah, I was trying to work. I thought it was intriguing that the character had that word or speech radical. So
it's in Shiva that wisdom emptiness is established.
I think the other way, that in Prajnaparamita, then Shiva is established or designated.
So what exactly does that mean?
I think it means in this, the monk is thinking that in this unarising, unceasing Prajnaparamita, we can think of a space within this bright, knowing space. All these realizations and practices are established, and he's amazed that within this non-arising and non-ceasing, unchanging reality, that these practices can happen and be established, and these realizations can happen. Yeah. They can either be established, loosely established, maybe we could say practiced, or maybe more Prajnaparamita-like language would be, they can be designated. It's kind of like the Diamond Sutra is constantly saying, cup, as no cup, this is taught, thus we designate it as a cup. This designation issue is really prominent in the Perfect Wisdom Sutras. So it might be like that, spirit. Nothing arises and ceases in the space, and yet, although nothing arises and ceases in Prajnaparamita, Shila is established or designated. Yes.
In all of your discussing of this thing and knowing, you never use the term conscious or awareness. Can you sort of explain?
I was just kind of trying to give some people a break. Yeah, I'm so tired of hearing this word awareness, especially the Santa Cruz people. I can't do this.
10 years.
They heard it for 10 years. But yes. I think prajna, the nya root is generally means knowing. And these variations of understanding, but also nya, at least jnana, is the Sanskrit for non-dual awareness. In Tibetan Buddhism, when they talk about, yeshe, primordial awareness. That yeshe is jnana in Sanskrit, and jna is the same root as prajna. I think in the Zen, so I think usually Prajnaparamita many people, I think, scholar types would say, you shouldn't really translate that as non-dual awareness. But Zen people, even old Zen people, like Dogen and Keizan, they, and I can't think of others, but I think they often do equate them. Non-dual awareness and Prajnaparamita. In fact, I think that's what Changsha is doing when he talks about the radiant light of the self is non-dual awareness. I think we can assuredly say that's what Changsha is talking about. And then he calls that Prajnaparamita. And I think Dogen's trying to point us that way, because the Heart Sutra, we usually don't think of the Heart Sutra talking about non-dual awareness. But I think Dogen's take on it in this essay is trying to sort of nudge us in that direction. So when I use the word premium knowing, I'm thinking of non-dual awareness. And jnana, very similar to prajna, even in Sanskrit, there are different nuances. And then consciousness, somebody had heard this. Consciousness, I like to use as the translation for vijnana. In fact, it seems to be across all Buddhist schools in the English-speaking world, almost everybody translates the fifth skanda, vijnana, as consciousness. So that, for that reason, I like to use the word consciousness for dualistic knowing, and the word awareness for non-dual knowing. But some other, people and traditions and use consciousness and awareness interchangeably. It's just that because we so commonly use the word consciousness for vijnana, we don't want to get people starting to equate the fifth skanda with non-dual awareness, because the Buddha taught from the get-go that all five aggregates are in their nature discontent, they're not true self, and they're all impermanent. Whereas this non-dual awareness is taught as not arising and ceasing, and our true self, and not suffering, but the opposite of vijnana. In that sense, the opposite. But they're both types of knowing. So they're both types of jnana. It's just that one is pure jnana and one is vijnana, which means like divided knowing, divided into the appearance of a subject knowing an object. Premium knowing, I would say, same as non-dual awareness, is the same as true self, is the same as Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, and thus it is Nyoze, and many, many other words in Zen. It's such kind of like the central issue. So there's infinite Zen words like the radiant light of the self. Ta-ta-ta. Ta-ta-ta. Yata-bhutam. Yeah, and even like jnana, darshana, vimoksha, all of this. Yeah. Yes.
I'm wondering if the correct way to understand things don't arise or cease is because of the intrinsic lack of selfness or self-existence. I'm not real happy with either of those words, but maybe you know what I mean. They don't arise or cease because there's no internal intrinsic existence.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes, that's right. And that's a more standard way, really, of are talking about prajnaparamita, emptiness teachings. No thing arises because it doesn't have any like essential thingness to arise. Exactly. It has no self nature. It has no inherent existence. And therefore, there's not really something there to arise, but it appears as if something arises. Yeah, if we say, this is like we're being careful with language, right? Sometimes we might say, when things arising and ceasing means that they're empty. Like things coming and going means that they're empty. But as soon as we use the word things, we kind of start thinking that there's something that arises and ceases. Like even an impermanent thing. Again, that's why emptiness is more profound than impermanence, because you could have a like a flower, and you could even watch it in fast motion film or something, where like a sprout, a seed comes up like this and sprouts as a flower, and then it doesn't get any water and it starts shriveling and dying. So this whole thing is completely, there's not a moment that it's still, it's totally impermanent. So that's, we really can see that the impermanence of that flower, but we still feel maybe like there's an actual impermanent flower there. There's still something called a flower that's arising and ceasing. It's easier to see the impermanence of something than that whole process of the arising and ceasing flower. The whole thing wasn't really even happening. Actually, according to Prajnaparamita, it's like, it's not even actually arising. The thing, the flower, is not the thing to arise, but even the idea of arising is really hard. This is where Nagarjuna, comes in and, starts strangling our brain. And he says, actually, if you look very carefully, there's no such thing as the process of arising. Wow. You can't find an actual interdependence. Actual. But because things, appear to arise dependent on other things, if we look carefully into that, we don't find anything actually there. And yet we definitely find the appearance of interdependence, interdependent arising things. Very profound. We should just think this to ourselves.
So talk a bit deeper than my question, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, but you said it very nicely the way you said it too. That because things have no intrinsic existence, therefore they don't arise or cease. If they don't arise, they can't cease. If they're not born, they can't die. So, yeah. Other questions? From the balcony? Deborah.
You mentioned that you, I guess, practice Dzogchen, and where does the Heart Sutra, is that somewhat of a similar process for Zen of practicing a direct approach or a non-dualistic approach? How are they different?
The Heart Sutra is central teaching of all Mahayana. And so Chinese Chan, Japanese Zen, Tibetan Dzogchen, all of these traditions, the Heart Sutra is central to all of them. And one of my Dzogchen teachers, Choki Nyima Rinpoche, a few years ago taught the Heart Sutra, went through that, and what was it that I was talking to him in a private discussion and said, was talking about teaching Zen or something. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said, oh, you know, in Zen, you really have to, help people clarify the Heart Sutra. That's like the heart of Zen as he understood it. And I think that's true. And, but also both Zen and Tibetan Dzogchen, Dzogchen's the great perfection in Tibetan, it's very much like Zen. They emphasize emptiness, and they also emphasize this kind of luminous emptiness, knowing emptiness. The vast sky is bright with awareness, aware emptiness, empty awareness. And Dzogchen, maybe even more than Zen, really gets into that, into the point of awareness. And because I really appreciate that, I find it so liberating in practice. Therefore, as a Zen person, I have I tend to like look for these kind of more positive, awareness-oriented expressions in the Zen teachings. And as soon as I started looking, I started finding them everywhere. Like, I think when I first looked at this essay of Dogen many years ago, I thought, yeah, it's kind of his, he's commenting on the Heart Sutra and he's playing with the word no, changing the word no into knowing. Which is in a parenthesis, I'll try not to lose the thread here, but it just reminded me the image of the great animated film Yellow Submarine. Has everyone seen Yellow Submarine? Classic Beatles. Colorful animation. And they have like the blue meanies, right? And they have, out in the field, they have the word no. K-N-O-W, right? They're celebrating, I think, the Beatles and the Pepperland. All the beings of Pepperland in the Yellow Submarine, they're celebrating, primo knowing. Right? So there's like the big three-dimensional word no, K-N-O-W, like on the, in the field, and the blue meanies come by and they smash the K and the W. And so it's left with N-O. No, right? So it's the kind of thing they do. Just say no. But then later in the movie, like when the rainbows all start coming and the Pepperland beings start like conquering the day and the Beatles start playing, the K and the W like I think start sprouting out of the ground again, and the N-O becomes a K-N-O-W once again. So anyway, I just thought of that because Dogen takes the N-O, no, from the Heart Sutra and changes it into just like the Beatles, changes it into a K-N-O-W. In this essay. And that's the kind of thing that I think the Dzogchen tradition is emphasizing, knowing maybe over this absence, over this negation. Emptiness is not a mere negation. And same with essays like this. That's what I was going to say. When I first saw this, I thought it was interesting, but the more I come to appreciate these awareness teachings and picking this up, like, I think that's what Dogen's trying to say. Could be wrong, but you can definitely read it that way. All these things are prajna, are kind of knowing. Yeah, back there. Yes, it is.
The
how it is that Shakyamuni Buddha teaches through the monk in the assembly who's thinking to himself. Maybe it's just so hard to teach that it's kind of an encouragement.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? That why didn't the Buddha just teach this in the sutra? It's a monk thinking to himself and the Buddha reading his mind. And literally it says knowing his mind. It's the same character for jnana. Interestingly, knowing. The Buddha knew the monk's mind and said, yose. So, and same with the Heart Sutra. The Buddha doesn't actually teach the Heart Sutra. The Buddha, like, empowers Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, to actually teach the Heart Sutra. And then there's some longer versions of the Heart Sutra that start with the stuff I heard and in a little setting. The Buddha goes into a samadhi, and then Avalokiteshvara starts having this conversation, Shariputra. And then at the end, the Buddha comes out of the samadhi and says, well done, Avalokiteshvara. So it is. Just like that. So, sometimes it's like it's too much for the Buddha to say it. So he has others think it.
We go along ordinarily and think the way realize this non-grasping, the way I'll grasp enlightenment of non-grasping is through precepts, or just diligent practice. This teaching is saying, all of that is kind of beyond the words.
Designations?
Yeah.
It does say that Shila is a designation within. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all manifest. And yet, a Zen way of looking at precepts is, again, rather than like, you know, get our life together at the beginning of practice. It's more like start practicing and opening to this. And then we express our non-duality with all beings. We express our unity through the precepts. We of non-separation, the precepts of non-separation. Particularly the Bodhisattva precepts, we can really look at them all as like expressions that we're not separate from other living beings. In order for there to be killing, there has to be an other, and we have to really be othering them to kill them, actually. If we see that other being as ourself, we can't kill it. Stealing.
Translated the first precept in his book. Not even to give rise to the view of extinction. Not even to imagine that there's extinction.
So there's not actually killing. No. Yeah. Nothing can be killed. Yeah. Dobin says this too, right? Life cannot be killed. And thus, from this view, then we don't kill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And stealing, right? It's like there's something that's not ours and we want to get it. It's separate from us. But if everything is us, then it doesn't make sense to steal. Right? So each of the precepts is a meditation on non-separation, if you can see it like that. I think that's kind of a Zen way of looking at precepts. And then to kind of like check ourselves, kind of like, well, maybe this sounds kind of like very profound, and to kind of check if our view is correct, then we can look at kind of the literal kind of thing, the literal meaning of the precept too, because ideally they would line up. There's nobody to kill, and therefore that kind of is expressed as not killing. of course, there's so much gray area with all precepts, right? Because how do we live in this world? So, but coming at it from the point of view of non-duality, it's kind of Zen style. Oh, please excuse me for going on so long in this this very verbose session. Any final points to be raised? It's almost lunchtime. Thanks for your patience. Bodhisattvas, Prajnaparamita Assembly.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.